This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, and this is episode number 377. It's just a few days after the election, and I can't even, I don't think, begin to bring myself to talk about it. So I'm just going to altogether avoid the subject for a while. Yeah, just going to be drinking. Self-medicating. One way I do self-medicate is by watching lots of films, so that's helpful because at least it helps with the podcast. So this goes out to all my listeners who, A, maybe feel a certain similarity to the way I feel, but also just needs a little time to ignore before they marinate. It's like first is denial, then numbness. I got it all wrong. Numbness is first, then denial, maybe then start to breathe. I'm expecting down the road I'll figure it out. But right now I'm just going to live in ignorance. That's how I'm going to be for a little while. Anyway, this episode is interesting. I've got two different folks that both work outside the mainstream of filmmaking here in New York, both in Brooklyn. One is a friend of the podcast and a friend of mine named Sue Friedrich. Sue has been on the show a couple of times before. Years ago, I curated a series of documentaries. We packaged it together as one little festival over the course of, I think it was like 9 months, interestingly enough. And each month, I think it was like the last Tuesday night or so, I don't remember exactly. This goes back a number of years now. But we would screen a documentary, a new documentary in most cases, about what is happening to the neighborhoods of Brooklyn through development and through politics. And we would invite the filmmakers, of course, but we'd also invite community organizers, politicians, religious leaders, you name it. And we would have these incredible discussions and turnouts at every screening. And I did this screening series at the Ethical Society of Brooklyn, which is a old house right on Prospect Park. It was a great, great series. I really miss it. And what's interesting is right now, well, we could use that kind of series again, and we may have to figure it out. But anyway, Sue Friedrich is back with a new film. Her last one was called The Gut Renovation, which was one of those films about development and how basically housing has become unaffordable and how neighborhoods have been upended. So her film, again, Sue's film, was called Gut Renovation, and she had been a squatter for many, many, many years in this loft in Williamsburg, you know, an industrial space. I mean, you know, I think there wasn't plumbing. I don't remember. For years it was like, you know, and then slowly over years, you know, she and her roommates, they built it into a real apartment, but ultimately, because of what happened in Williamsburg in the last 10 years. They were thrown out of this space. And this is a really angry film, Gut Renovation, and it's about that period. There's a lot of humor in it, too, but it's angry humor. Well, Sue and I became friends as a result of that film, and I showed it, and she's back with a new film, a very different subject. It's about her mother, who is in her 90s, and who, after Sue's father dies, Sue and her siblings are relocating their mom up to the New York area from Chicago. So, or over, I should say, to New York from Chicago. So that's what this documentary is about. And it's going to have a screening on November 17th at BAM. I'm just going to get the time for you in case after you hear this, it interests you and you want to go and see the movie. And, oh, they're pairing it with one of her older movies. I should mention that, too. We're going to talk about that in this conversation coming up in a minute. So, it's being billed as an evening with Sue Friedrich. And, okay, the evening starts at 7:30. Again, if you go to BAM.org, you'll find it easily. But so it's going to have the premiere screening of her new film, which is called I Can't Tell You How I Feel. And they're going to be showing her earlier 80s film as well, The Ties That Bind, which I think that was the name, with her mom, about her mother, but very different films. My second segment is with Steve Cosman, who is a friend, and he is the founder of Mono Aware, which is a nonprofit cinema arts organization based here in Brooklyn, which is also a resource for the film community and the preservation of, I'd say, film that's outside of conventional filmmaking. It's great. And they're having right now, as of this past November 3rd, just I guess last week, they're having their 10th annual Cinema Arts Festival. And it goes through December 3rd, and it is very ambitious, and we're going to talk a lot about that. But if you go to the Mono no Aware website, it's mononoawarefilm.com, you can find out all the details about all of the goings-on in Brooklyn, in Manhattan, and in Staten Island. Then we'll be talking with Steve. So, and then, before I can end the intro, I had to also mention another very sad event in a sad week, which is the passing of the great Leonard Cohen at age 82. I was lucky to grow up with his music, first of all, and it was part of the soundtrack of my youth and even my adulthood. And secondly, I was very, very, very lucky to see him in concert early in his first comeback tour a few years back, when basically all of his money was stolen and he had to go back on the road and start touring, and he did quite well and audiences loved it. And he had discovered a newfound passion for performing live, which had seemed to have dissipated years earlier, but he was very, I don't know. There was a recent article in the New Yorker, which I read about him, and it sounded like he was having trouble. But it also, he talked about how much he really was moved and inspired by the last couple of tours that he did. And I have to say, when I saw him, which is about three or four years ago, I can't remember, but it was one of the best concerts I had ever seen in all the probably hundreds of shows I've seen, large and small. And he's performed for nearly 4 hours. I'm going to say it was a good 3.5 hours, if not longer. So at the very end of this podcast, even though it's his most popular and most covered song, it is a very beautiful and emotional song. And so here's what's going to happen then. Throughout this podcast, as I did at the very beginning, I'm going to play Leonard Cohen music. And at the very end, I'm going to do something I have never done on all 377 episodes. I have not done yet in any of the 377 episodes, and that is to play a song on my guitar for you. So that's coming up at the end of this episode. Let me know what you think about that, by the way. It's a little self-indulgent, but I felt I wanted to express my love for Leonard Cohen and the music of Leonard Cohen. So on this rather somber day, I apologize. I could not just switch gears, though. But on this somber day, these two conversations, again, first with Sue Friedrich, regarding her film, I Cannot Tell You How I Feel. And I can't. Follow, and then we'll be back with Steve. Thank you.
The window, my little darling. I'd like to try to read your palm. I used to think I was some kind of gypsy boy. Before I let you take me home. Now so long, Marianne. It's time we began to lie and cry and cry and laugh about it all. Well, you know that I love to live with you.
The reason we're talking is because your new documentary, which is called
I Cannot Tell You How I Feel,
which is about your mom, is going to have a screening at BAM in a matter of days from when we're sitting here. So that's kind of the underlying focus of rationale anyway of why we're talking. But it's also nice to have you back.
Thank you for having me back.
I have a lot of fond memories of our screening and some years ago, and you came on to the podcast, and we can now divulge that our last podcast, I don't know if you remember these circumstances, but we sort of did a hoax on my listeners. Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Oh, you're going to laugh. Well, you were late.
Yes.
And you came into Dumbo, but I wanted to do was get into that because time was tight. I wanted to get into the car with you.
Oh, that's right.
And drive around.
I remember that.
Williamsburg with you and have you do an audio documentary sort of pointing out spots and what happened and to the neighborhood and your experiences in the neighborhood.
Right.
And you said, well, can we, you had this great idea because the time was tight. So you said, well, can we go into the car, drive around so you get the
atmosphere.
Right. Yeah. But I'll just fake it.
I'll just pretend.
Yeah, right. That we're in Williamsburg. So we just drove around like Williams
true.
Dumbo for about 20 minutes.
Right.
But it came out very well.
Very
really
convincingly.
Funny. Oh. It did.
So nobody will believe anything
Sorry.
I say this
oh,
time.
Oh, no, that's true. I just said true.
Here we are sitting in Trump Tower having a conversation.
That's right. Well, just for some more context, this was during a period a few years ago where there was a crop, if you will, of documentaries about New York, but it's more so in Brooklyn, and what was happening to our neighborhoods, you know, with rezoning and development in general, you know, and your, of course, Gut Renovation, which was your penultimate film, the prior film before this one, was about your experience of losing your home in
right.
Williamsburg. So, and you've been here now in Bed-Stuy for
7
wow.
years and some months. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, basically in 2008, I started looking, and we moved in 2009,
okay.
summer.
It must have been going back to, I mean, you have dealt with family in your number of your films already, so this was kind of going back to that, right?
The new film.
Yeah, the new film, excuse me.
Yes. Although one thing that's funny about the screening at BAM, which is on November 17th.
Thank you.
Is that they...
At 7?
7:30. Yeah.
Okay.
They decided to program it with The Ties That Bind. So that's a film I made in 1984.
Okay.
About my mother. And of course, this one is about my mother.
30 years later.
Yes. And so they thought, well, let's see what happened in the last 30 years. And I said, well, that's fine. You're the programmers. But I never thought that this film was a sequel. In any way related to The Ties That Bind, except for the fact that they're both about the same person. Because the other film, it tells sort of the drastic tales of her life in Germany during the Second World War, where she grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first long film I made, and it was sort of a looking back at the past of this other person. And when I started making this, I didn't have it in mind at all, except to think, well, I did make another film about her, but it's not as if I meant to, you know, mirror it in any way, or just, I just didn't think of it in relationship to this one. Because this one is very much about the present. It's about,
yeah, right.
Wow, look where we are and look what we're going through. And, okay, that's what this film is. And so it'll be interesting for me to see them together. Because actually, as I went along in the edit of this film, mm-hmm. there were a couple of moments when I wanted to sort of show very briefly something about her character, let's say, or her activities in her daily life. Mm-hmm. And so I did use some clips from The Ties That Bind, showing her
sure.
swimming and,
right.
you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
but and then I even wondered, like, well, if somebody sees this without knowing The Ties That Bind, will they understand where this footage comes from? It might just look like home movie footage. Mm-hmm. So it's a funny thing. Yeah.
You'll be able to kind of discuss. Now, let me ask you a question, and I assume you don't mind divulging the answer.
No.
You were, if you can let me know, we'll I'm see. Sure you'll tell me otherwise. How old was your mom when you made The Ties That Bind?
She was born in 1920. I finished it in 1984. So
64. Now, you are roughly how old when you made I Cannot Tell You How I Feel?
I am about to turn 62.
Okay. So now this is something you reflected on at some point in the film itself, but you kind of noted
yeah.
Something about being the age your mother was.
Yes. That was a very weird moment. And that does have to do with The Ties That Bind, because in the new film, I visit her in Chicago and somebody takes a picture of us. It's the summer and we're walking along the lake. And in the film, it fades into a picture that was taken of us when I was making The Ties That Bind. Mm. And in that photograph, she's 63. And I have lived for all these years with that photograph, knowing that I'm getting older, of course, but still, it's always my mother, the woman with the gray hair, who's a lot older than me mm-hmm. in the photograph.
Yeah, sure.
And suddenly, I'm only 2 years younger than her. And that was, aside from many other things, that was very confusing.
Yeah.
Or wake up.
It was a wake up call. It is odd, because if I recall my dad, I certainly have memories of my father at my current age and being an adult then.
Right.
Albeit a young adult.
Right.
But the point being, I know what you mean. Is the film, the new one, which again is called I Can't Tell You How I Feel, right? Which is something your mom says
right.
during the, because she's so overwhelmed, just being distraught. Because the backdrop, I should mention, of the film or what's going on during this period of time that you're shooting the film is that she's being moved from her home of, I don't know how many years.
Like 52.
52 years in Chicago to just outside of New York City.
Right.
Which, you know, for anybody is a big deal. But for somebody who is as old as your mom is, right, because she's in her 90s?
Yeah, she was 94 when we started moving her. She just turned 96. Her birthday's on Halloween. So, yeah.
Is there a level, I guess my question would be, she's not really putting things in the context of aging because she's been older for a while. So, but are you? I mean, is this
Well, actually,
also...
one day she said to me, because she'll say like, oh, I'm so I don't want to be old. And one day she said, you know, I'd really love if I were 20 years younger.
Yeah.
I was like, Mom, that would make you 75. That's not
yes,
exactly
right.
a young person.
Right.
But I think everything's relative. So
that's right. A
must
spry. Well, she was
her.
Probably darn like youthful at 75
was,
because
yeah.
in the 90s she's still
yeah.
Very mobile. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, if you were to ask because of her forgetfulness, if she were diagnosed, my guess is the doctor would say she's 93. That's her diagnosis. I mean, it's not like
exactly.
I mean, at 93, you know.
Things you, start to fade, yes.
Things, yeah, it's not. Yeah. It's a lot of years to remember, let alone just a lot on your mind. I don't know. I mean, she.
Right.
The epilogue of the film is she's now in New York, and you go to visit, she didn't remember that you were coming that day.
Right.
Now, again, it's just being 93, because she, you know. My yeah. mother, if I go visit her, she doesn't know my name. She doesn't know what our relationship. She knows she loves me. She'll tell me that, but she doesn't
uh-huh.
know who. Well, yeah.
That's the next level. I know that hasn't happened yet, but the day that she says, oh, hi, do I know you?
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be pretty rough. I mean, I went through that with my grandparents, so.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
slightly
may not
prepared,
happen.
But it's different
yeah.
when it's your parent.
Yeah. 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 And my mom is a good over 12 or 13 years younger than... Well, how old is your mom? I'm sorry.
She just turned 96.
96?
Yeah.
15 years younger than your... 16 years younger than your mother. But she's... yeah. Gone. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So it's a different thing. But I think a lot of people are going to be able to identify this relationship is... It's to see somebody who's in their early 60s and still grappling with those difficulties with their parent. Yeah. It's quite a universal thing.
One of the feelings I had when I was doing it, and certainly just in living my life while I was making the film, was the fact that we never got any training in dealing with this stuff, right? You know, of course, any of us could have taken a workshop about what happens when your parents start going through this. We could have read books, you know, but we don't. When you're our age or younger, you're just thinking about your life. You're just doing what you're doing. And, you know, somebody else who's a little older may say, oh God, my grandfather has Alzheimer's or what, you know, you may hear about it and think, oh, that sounds terrible. But I don't think any of us think, well, I'm going to be prepared because I'm, you know, and so suddenly it happens and you have no guidelines. And it's actually kind of reminiscent to me of what happened when we did have to leave Williamsburg and decided to buy a house instead of rent again. And I never owned anything. And the learning curve for, like, what's a mortgage? How do you do this? How do you even begin? Was really steep. And, you know, I sort of got through it. We got a place. It all worked out. But this is sort of similar, but of course much more emotionally charged.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was really lucky that my sister and brother live here also. And
they're both in New York.
They're both in New York. My sister's in Park Slope and my brother lives up in Westchester. And they're both very capable and responsible and, you know, all of that. And so between the three of us, we were able to figure out what to do. Like, okay, Pete's going to find the lawyer and my sister's going to deal with the doctors and I'm going to deal with the real estate, you know, and we could kind of cross-reference what we were doing and work it all out, as opposed to doing it alone. And I've already, you know, in making a film, you're always meeting people and talking about the subject. And even now, I mean, I premiered it in Vienna and talked to people there. And meeting people who are alone when they do it, you know, they're either because they're the only child or they have siblings who just won't lift a finger. And I feel so sorry for people who have to do this alone because it's incredible. It's just overwhelming, the amount of stuff that one has to do.
Yeah, it is true. I have a sister, so it was very helpful. But I have friends up in upstate, and I think I was visiting, and they were kind of really telling me a lot about, they both had gone through just 2 years or more of just drama with all their parents, all four of their parents, just so much drama. But I did learn a bit, and I kind of knew the right questions to ask. And I learned what I had to do to get my dad the help he needed.
Uh-huh.
Because he's just not ambitious. I didn't know this. I mean, you know, he was always a provider when I was growing up. You know, always got home after work and provided and was there, present. We went on vacation, you know. But it wasn't until my mom was gone until I realized who really kind of, I don't want to say ran the family, but who was the kind of the force behind the family.
Right.
And that was my mother, because when she's gone, my dad, and given he's now his 80s as well, of course, that has something to do with it. But, you know, he just was willing to go status quo. Every time something, it's like having a car and you never do any preventative tuning up with the car. You just wait till things break. As they break down, you get them patched together. And soon you just have this kind of lemon, you know. And this is what was happening. He wouldn't do anything proactive about it. So I realized I got to get, you know, and he's spending his money, all of his money. But why don't we try to get her on Medicaid, or why aren't we trying to do getting all these services that she may be, you know, so it was, I just had to sort of
dig in my heels. With, when a person dies, and this summer my father passed away.
Well,
and
sorry about that.
Thank you. And, my brother was for probably 2 months before dealing with him about all his finances.
Right.
And you know, then there was the funeral and all of that, and looking at it, you know, the day after it happened, I thought, oh, Well, this is also another big step of something that you should know about. And I talked to Pete, and he said, yeah, and you know what? The whole funeral industry in this country is such a ripoff, like so many other things, you know.
The wedding industry, too.
The wedding industry. So there you are, you know, totally in grief, and suddenly there's this funeral director saying, well, maybe you'd like the most expensive coffin and the most expensive whatever. And I remember they asked.
So, Raven style.
Huh? Yeah. And so my father's cremated, and there was an urn, and the funeral director asked my brother, and it was like a 5-minute walk from the funeral home to the cemetery. And the funeral director asked him if he would like to have the hearse drive the urn to the cemetery. My brother's like, no, I'll carry it. It weighs like 5 pounds, right?
Right?
And how much would they have charged for, you know, the hearse to transport it?
Right.
So it's like there are so many things about this that are, again, I think we don't really want to think about them. We don't want to know about them until it happens. But, you know, buyer beware, like sometimes it helps to know things ahead of time.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So do you realize you were moving your mother down to New York, right? And that was, of course, a huge obstacle, no doubt. I'm assuming she put up something of a fight for her.
A bit, yeah.
Right? And we see some of that, although it seems like it's already resolved by the time the film is in the present. But, I mean, were you feeling like the urge to tell this new story, or this particular story just was speaking to you? Or I guess I'm wondering how you knew it was time to start making a new film. Probably a better way of putting it.
Yeah, that is a good question. It's always a good question. I mean, when anything is done, how do you start the new one? What's the new one going to be?
Well, gut renovation, you know, for instance, had a much more universal – there was this thing that was going on. There was a context to it.
The whole neighborhood was experiencing this thing.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yes, it, you know, that came from, I think, a lot from that sense of this shared experience. And in this case, it was more, I mean, one of the things about the film is that I really tried, and also with the help of my partner, who's a very good editor and has a good sense of humor, I tried to inject some humor in the film because this could potentially be a really dreary subject and really depressing. And there are humorous aspects to it.
Right.
And so early in the film, my mother asks if I'm going to come along with her as they leave the house. And on the screen, because I use a lot of text in the film, I say, yes, but I'm going to be hiding behind my camera. Now, that was written after the fact, you know, when I was editing, and I heard her ask me that question on camera.
Oh, and you recorded it after the fact?
Well, yeah, I'm looking at the footage, it's the day she leaves, and I'm looking at the shot where she says, Susie, you're going to come with us? And I say, yeah. And as I was editing, I thought, yes, but I'm going to hide behind my camera, because while I was editing, I kept kind of thinking about the fact that I had been having my camera on during so much of this, because I knew that I wasn't thinking at the beginning, like, I'm going to make a film about moving my mother. You know, that absolutely was not my thought. I thought, holy shit, we have to do all of this. It's going to ruin the summer. It's going to be a nightmare. And I realized that my little, like, Sony pocket, you know, photo camera also shot video. So I just started using it, and she wasn't aware of it. And it was partly just to, you know, I thought, well, maybe I'll just look at this footage later so I remember what happened, because I'm so freaked out that I'm not going to remember what it was like. In one case, like when we were looking at the place where we were going to move her, it was the same way when you buy a house, like you just go in with a little video camera to, you know, like that, oh God, what street was that house on? What did it look like? So just to have like a video record of it. So there were various ways in which I picked up the camera and used the camera. But at some point, you know, early in the fall, after we had done the whole move and everything, I thought, you know, I've got a lot of footage here. I've got a lot of ideas. So let me see what happens if I start editing. So it kind of went like that.
And then a story emerges.
And a story emerged.
Mm.
Plus, as I said before, when you're having this experience, you just start meeting tons of people who are having it. Friends, strangers, whatever. And so the more I was in the experience and talking to people, the more I thought, well, this might be something that other people would like to see, either because it will reflect their own experience, or if you're younger, it might be sort of instructive in some way. And actually, you know, when I showed it in Vienna, a couple of people after the first, so it was the very first screening to a big audience of the film, and I had no idea how people would feel. And afterwards, a number of people came up to me and said, that was so liberating. And I was like, it was liberating? And they said, yeah, because I think those things also, and I'm afraid to think them, and I think I'm a really bad person if I think them. And I'm really glad you said those things.
Do you have a sense that you're far more, maybe more outspoken than the average when it comes to personal feelings?
Well,
or your personal life?
I might be a little bit more, yes.
Well, you might be so accustomed to it because you've made how many films about...
Well, they're not all about family, but I mean, I've made 24 films. And
yeah,
I mean, a bunch of them are pretty frank, I would say, about stuff that goes on between people in families
or what you're going through.
Or like, well, The Odds of Recovery was about medical problems or issues, and I think there were some very frank moments in that. So I do try to say it like it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think there are certain parts of the, you know, world where that's not what people do. You know, it's not the way you're supposed to be. But I think people do want it. Or maybe they just, as this person, you know, as this person admitted that, I think a lot more people probably wish they could be more frank about.
Well, it's
not be ashamed of their these feelings.
These feelings. But it's like reading, you know, Fun Home, the Alison Bechdel book. And, Or Roz Chast's book, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And, you know, I read those and think, thank you so much for being so upfront about what really goes on, you know, in these situations. But I don't know if Roz and Alison had somebody sitting at their elbow. But in my case, you know, I go along, I'm editing, and once in a while I'll say to Kathy, hey, could you look at this? Tell me what you think.
Right.
And there was one moment in particular, which I won't say now because if somebody sees it, I'd rather they just experience it for the first time. But there was this one moment where I was saying something about my mother and feeling like, oh, yes, and I'm so much like her. I'm her daughter. And I had said something, and Kathy said, that is so, like, euphemistic and kind of wishy-washy, and that's not how you really feel. And I said, oh, you're right. And I said, so what do I really feel? I kind of know, but I'm not going to say it. And she said, well, let's talk about this. And I ended up, you know, sort of with her writing this little statement, and which I thought was so, like, exposing of me. And then she said, and I did a recording of it, and she said, yeah, but you know what you should do? You should whisper it. I was like, that's a great idea. So... you know, I sort of performed it in this desperate whisper. So I wouldn't say I'm always able to be as frank, but with her prodding me a little bit, I get a little more frank.
Keeping you honest. Did your mom get a chance to see it? No. That's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen.
It would be too painful?
I think it would disturb her. I don't think it would do her any good, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, I don't think she would... be whatever. And also, it's really bizarre when somebody is in the state that my mother is in now, which is to say that she forgets 3 minutes later what happened. Did we just have lunch? Yes. You know, you barely...
Right.
The dish is still in front of you kind of thing. To me, I don't even understand what it would mean for her to see it if 5 minutes later she would forget that she had seen it. Because, you know, you want to show something to somebody, let's say, because then you will talk. They will reflect on it. They will get back to you. They will, you know, you might change it. And with her, it would just sort of disappear. And so, I don't know. I just don't want to do it.
I wonder if you would be so good when you come to visit tomorrow. Would you bring me... I'm really very, very confused about what I have and what I don't have anymore and what is where with, you know, all that has gone on now. So if you could straighten that out for me so that I have a picture of what I actually have, I would. would appreciate that very much. Okay? Thanks a lot. Bye.
Well, I tell you, it's not nice to be my age.
Well, Mom, it's not bad considering your condition. You're in good shape for your age.
Yeah, that's what everybody says, you know. You should just be so happy. My God, look at the shape you are in.
Yeah.
Well, look at the pumpkins. I love that.
Has she seen a lot of your work?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What does she make of it?
She likes it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's interested in it. She, yeah, she's happy that I'm a filmmaker. So I don't feel like I wouldn't show it to her because hasn't been supportive of me.
Yeah.
And of course, the real experience of showing her a film of mine was when I did The Ties That Bind. So it was a completely different situation before. And I was working in film then, so that meant all the expense and trouble of getting a print. So I showed it to her when it was still on the editing table so that I could be sure that what I had said was correct, how I represented her was correct. And I felt that was really necessary, and we, you know, worked it out fine. So,
yeah. I mean, I understand also why BAM is pairing. You know, I mean, from a programming standpoint, but also it's specific to the career of Sue Friedrich, too, because I think your films do talk to each other. And I think there's something that is different about your body work than a lot of other documentary filmmakers who are looking for the subject, you know. So they kind of work together if you watch. I mean, I've only seen maybe four or five, I think. But, you know, it seems like they work together.
Yeah.
You know, you're seeing your life in a, you know, in stages.
It's weird because there are so many thousands at this point, people who know so much about me, and I don't know. Like, I'll have somebody come up to me at a screening who says, you know, oh, I've seen all your films, and they'll start talking about my father and my old, you know, my partner and my this and my that. And I'm like, and it's so weird because it's like they really know tons of stuff about me, and I don't know who they are. I don't even know their name.
Yeah.
And it's odd. It's odd. But, I mean, of course, that's going to happen if I do the kind of work I do. But, you know, another thing about showing those two films together that kind of just occurred to me is that I had made about four or five short films, also silent films, before I made the Ties That Bind. So that was like my big, sort of my big breakthrough. I'm going to start working with sound. It's going to be 54 minutes instead of 15 minutes. You know, it was really a leap for me.
Yeah.
But it was also going to be a documentary of sorts. But because I had come out of this experimental film tradition and had all kinds of principles and beliefs and whatever about film, I chose not to do any talking heads in it. I didn't shoot any sync sound. I shot everything with the Bolex. You hear her in voiceover. I mixed incredible amounts of images together to tell the story. And so it was, on the one hand, my first documentary, in quotes, my first documentary, and I've made a bunch since, but it was the first of what has been a series of films, which some people could call a documentary, because it's a record of somebody alive in the real world, as opposed to an actor, but it's quite unconventional in its form from a regular documentary. And so is this film. So, you know, I feel like 30 years later, I still am really interested in picking up my camera and shooting the world in front of me, but that doesn't mean I'm going to do a Talking Heads documentary. And I have nothing, I have no objection to that kind of film. I see lots of them. I think they're great, but it's not who I am. So I think in a way this shows that in all these years, I haven't really left some of those early
principles.
Ideas that I had.
I understand.
Yeah.
That's a great way of putting it. There's a through line.
There's more humor now than there was in the past. Oh. I think The Ties That Bind was very serious. Mm-hmm. And this is has more humor. Yeah.
You've lightened up a bit.
Well, I just think humor is a really important part of life.
Yeah.
You know.
Especially when you're confronting all this mortality stuff.
Yeah.
True. Really have to use it or tap it, because otherwise
Getting old isn't for sissies, as Betty Davis said. Yeah. Yeah.
The name, again, of the documentary is called I Cannot Tell You How I Feel, directed by Sue Friedrich.
Can I say something about the title?
Yeah.
Okay.
Please.
So, I have made, 23, 24 films. All of them have a title that's some form of idiom, aphorism, saying, whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
Like,
renovation.
Gently down the stream, damned if you don't, the ties that bind, rules of the road, sink or swim, the odds of recovery. You get the picture right from the ground up. Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Every time I've made a film in the last decade or more, I've thought, don't do it this time. Come up with a title that isn't a known thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I always end up with a known thing.
Right.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So this time, again, I thought, I have no idea what the title is. Let's see what happens. Please let it not be. And I like the titles. I don't mind them. I just think sometimes you shouldn't do what you've always done, right?
Sure.
So when I shot that, what is the first scene of the film of her talking, sort of traumatized the day she's leaving. So I was filming her, and I thought she was finished what she was saying. And I turned off the camera, but she continued talking. So I quickly turned the camera back on. But it meant that the shot kind of fell to the floor and then got back up on her. So when I was editing, I thought, oh, well, that's a mess. That looks terrible. What am I going to do? How am I going to cover it? I'll find some old photographs of her, whatever. So I just put black over it. And then I was editing, and I heard her say, I cannot tell you how I feel, and then continue talking when she came back on camera. But this phrase was where the image was a mess.
It was a blank. Yeah.
And I just thought, well, that's the title. And then I really loved it because I could make the title come up on the screen while you heard it being said. But also, it's her saying it because it's her voice. But it's me saying it because it's the title of my film. And there's a great irony in it because guess what? She does tell us how she's feeling. And
right.
Guess what? So do I.
Certain terms.
So I was just like, yay! I love this.
Finally. And you've been liberated.
That's right.
And the screening again is on at BAM.
Thursday, November 17th.
November 17th, which is coming right up. So.
Right. And it's only that one night. Sometimes people think, oh, it's a week run,
right.
Whatever. But in this, and I, hopefully I'll show it at other places around the city. But at the moment, that's it. And it's the New York premiere. So I'm very excited.
Yeah, it's a great venue for
it
your
is.
Premiere. And did you just submit it, or what?
I sent it to one of the programmers and just said, let me know what you think. And she wrote back and said, we'd love to show it. So
that's a nice answer that,
yes.
Maybe you were kind of hoping for somewhere.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
It's time we begin. To laugh and cry and laugh about it all again. We met when we were almost young.
Once again, everybody, this is my conversation with the founder. I believe executive director of Mano no Aware, which again is having its 10th annual Cinema Arts Festival November 3rd through December 3rd. So at this very moment in New York, please do check out manonoawarefilm.com for more details about that. And here's my conversation with Steve Cosman. Is the founder and executive director of Mano no Aware, which is in its 10th season, actually, as we're talking today. So I have it's upon me to really get my shit together and edit and post this.
It's a month long.
So maybe
take your time.
Maybe next week, because I'll have a little bit more time to get it together. But the 10th Annual Cinema Arts Festival is taking place between November 3rd and December 3rd all over the city. You had your opening night festivities.
Opening night.
At the Anthology Film Archives in the East Village. Great institution in New York, right?
Yeah. They've been like a strong supporter of our organization from day one and
right.
A huge ally.
Mm-hmm.
And our board president, Ava Tuis, was kind enough to curate the first night.
Mm-hmm.
The structure of the 10th anniversary festival was that we would co-curate with a number of institutions and curators and artists, work with them to kind of present this community, community curated festival.
Right. And what's like a side effect of that is you're also celebrating unique and I think ambitious programming, film curating in New York. Because Mana no Aware, like the Anthology Film Archives and a few other organizations that come to mind, whether it's Union Docs, there's a few, and probably more than I'm aware of, that are a little bit more ambitious in their approach to curation.
Well, certainly our annual exhibition up until this point, the last 9 years, has focused on expanded cinema, specifically sculptural installation work that incorporates the moving image, as well as durational and performative work that presents work on film. And then I would say about like 6 or 7 years ago, we expanded that programming into the entire year, putting on a series of monthly screenings called Connectivity Through Cinema, which is kind of the core of our mission statement, bringing people together for shared experience through different activities that are cinematic in nature, whether it be through our educational initiatives or presentations or lectures.
Where do those take place?
So we have kind of a home office, which is my live-work studio, downtown Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And you know, some of the smaller workshops happen there, our optical printing workshops, titling workshops, some of our special offerings like how to build your own looping system for 16 millimeter. We did color photogramming at the home office. But the majority of the dry workshops happen at the Center for Performance Research, which we've also had a very wonderful symbiotic relationship with. It's a dance studio, and they're interested in, you know, the study of motion through dance, and a lot of their performances happen on Friday and Saturday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of come in and teach Monday through Thursday evenings and work to have some of our screening presentations on like a Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
We also partnered with the Gowanus Darkroom, you know, very close to here. And they've also been extremely kind in letting us occupy that space in a variety of ways to present screenings, also to have a beautiful space to conduct some of the wet lab workshops that we offer, some of the surface treatment workshops, non-toxic processing black and white negative, using coffee and beer.
Is that right?
Yeah, some of our cross-processing workshops, processing color negative as reversal. it's just been really amazing.
You seem so ambitious and extremely productive.
I feel like I'm not doing enough.
Is that true? And then you travel endlessly, right, with Mana no Aware as well.
Yeah, so our workshops started 8 years ago in my living room. I used to live in Bushwick on Melrose, next to the Party Expo when they used to run shows.
Mm-hmm.
And we taught 4 workshops out of my living room, using the bathroom as a dark room. And we had about 25, 30 participants between the 4 classes, and saw the kind of interest and need for that type of like accessible, you know, workshop, hands-on learning. And since then, it's grown into a 6-month-a-year program with 7 to 9 workshops offered every month. We engage with over 400 participants each year now locally. And then we have an outreach program which extends, you know, beyond our host spaces. And that can be, you know, last summer we were at the Queens Museum, and we worked with the nonprofit New New Yorkers, which helps recent immigrants assimilate through different creative practices. And we offered a Super 8 workshop, you know, for free to that community where they could shoot and process and edit. And then we had like kind of a screening party at the Queens Museum presenting their works on film.
Wow.
And that was a lot of fun. Right. We were also at the Q Art Foundation not that long ago. We offered a workshop at the Ace Hotel.
We have a new partnership with them.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, a great story and maybe speaks to the good nature mm-hmm. of the organization and the community. Mm-hmm. I reached out to them a couple times and got an email from someone who heads their creative team. And it turns out it's an old friend of mine from like 15 years ago.
Really?
We had met. Uh-huh. And we got to catch up and...
Right.
They said that they're really excited about what we're doing and the different ways we're engaging with the community, and they'd like to support in any way they could. But the outreach, the educational outreach is, you know, is something that's growing just as fast as the local initiatives. And we've been invited to a number of universities to come and offer these classes as kind of like a supplemental component to what they're offering within their own curriculum.
Like what school?
Like 2 weekends ago, mm-hmm. I was at OKU, mm-hmm. Oklahoma University, yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And that was another great story. I would say last year I received an email from a student there asking to purchase film stock. We run a film distribution initiative. We import and distribute different types of film stocks to make them accessible to the community at large. And a student there had emailed asking about purchasing film stock, and I had sent it to her through the mail. And she responded saying the film looked great, and she was interested if we had sort of a work-study program for the summer. So after speaking with her, with Lauren, I had set up something for the summer, and she came here and worked with us for a little bit over a month, went back to the school, kind of re-energized, and started a film club. And asked students if they would be interested in learning more, like analog film practices. And the response was overwhelming. She had about 50 students on campus interested in learning mm-hmm. and was able to allocate the funds to bring one of us down to come and teach like a 24-hour intensive workshop. So I flew down on a Friday.
In a row?
Huh?
24 in a row?
Well, on Friday I flew down. Kind of got situated within their space. And then Saturday we worked from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. And Sunday we did 10 a.m. to 1:30 in the morning. And
then wow.
I flew back on Monday.
Okay.
And it was exciting.
Yeah.
And it was great to just go, you know, mm-hmm. Hands-on yeah, and right. work with their department and the group. Yeah, we worked with 10 of the students. And then the idea was that the
10-year-olds.
Yeah, 19, 20.
Amazing.
And the idea was that then they will share that knowledge with the rest of the club and hopefully like revitalize the interest in that that department in analog filmmaking. Yeah, so the outreach, through outreach, yeah. we just last month we were in Minneapolis mm-hmm. at an artist-run lab called Mirror Lab. Mm-hmm. We were at OKU mm-hmm. in Oklahoma, and then we were also at this film festival, mm-hmm. Documentary film festival in Kentucky just last weekend.
Oh, what was that called?
River's Edge Documentary okay. Film mm-hmm. Festival. And so, yeah, it's not limited to universities and colleges. We try right. and engage, you know, in
yeah.
different ways.
Right.
Different
and,
structures and communities.
And when you're in Kentucky, you're in the community. I mean, it's not an urban center where it's going to be like a lot of the insider group of people that go to all the festivals. It's you know, there's going to be a little bit of that, but most of the people that are going to that kind of festival are the local community that
yeah.
are interested in arts. So it's good.
We've been trying to do that quite a bit. I mean, all of our initiatives are geared towards making it as affordable and accessible as possible. Mm-hmm. There are some festivals that we have a 4 or 5 year relationship with at this point. One of them being the Oak Cliff Film Festival, just outside of Dallas. It's run out of the Texas Theater, and I've been going there every summer for the last 5 years and teaching workshops. And the idea being that we engage the community and allow people to come in and get their hands on, and then those films become an entry or an introductory program to something that's part of the festival as a way to engage the community and make them feel like they're a part of what's happening.
So for your Cinema Arts Festival, which is going on right now, where should people...
The snoring dog is great.
The snoring dog, yeah, that's Lucy. And
I love
it.
I've
had her for many years. She's turning 14 tomorrow.
Oh.
I mean, that's the birthday we decided, you know, kind of almost arbitrarily. But we knew that. I remember she was born in November, but I think we just kind of...
Scorpio.
She literally kept me up a lot last night because... And I have to wake her up so I can try to slip back to sleep before she starts snoring again. If I don't, then she'll, if she starts snoring, I can't get to sleep. Anyway, so where do people like begin? I mean, right now I'm going to guess as people, the show will be my podcast segment with you, Steve Kosman, who is the founder and executive director of Mono no Awari, will be going up in the, already now, like probably on the second week of the festival, which again, just does go through December 3rd. So there's lots and lots of opportunities to see and to be involved in programming and to see all sorts of cinema. So where do people go? You have the website. I assume that's a good place to start, right? Mononowawarefilm.com. That's M-O-N-O.
N-O.
And then I lose my... Oh, right. N-O-N-O. Okay. M-O-N-O-N-O. A-W-A-R-E-film.com.
So, yeah, we have a calendar section on the site, and it lists all the programming. There's 21 events as part of this film festival.
Yeah. And how many of the boroughs?
We're in three of the boroughs.
Okay.
Manhattan, Staten Island, and Brooklyn.
Okay. So we see it wasn't Queens.
Yeah.
Staten Island.
We considered Queens and tried.
Yeah. We did just do this other event there.
Yeah. There are 21 events throughout the three boroughs. We're presenting the work of 150 artists.
Wow.
And 14 of the events are free.
That's a lot.
The other
costs like $500. Yeah. You have to buy a table.
The other events that have a small entry fee, really it's, you know, either by donation or it's something where the host venue themselves are, you know, a similar structure to Mono where we feel like they need or deserve the support, you know, the same way that we do. You know, and there are workshops, there are screenings, presentations, and the last two nights of the event are kind of the traditional expanded cinema festival. So that'll have the more installation work and the durational performative work as part of it. And that's kind of like the culmination of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I've got a program right here with me, so I'm able to leap through. Thank you for bringing that. So I'll definitely be trying to make it. Oh, I see you're at the Maisel Cinema.
Yeah.
Which I've done some things with them over the years. The Gowanus Darkroom, as you mentioned. Brooklyn Fireproof, sure. That's in
Bushwick.
Bushwick, yeah, I've been there too.
Another great part of this festival is, you know, aside from trying to celebrate the community by representing all the institutions and artists and curators that we've had the opportunity to work with throughout the last decade. We also wanted to show our support of some of the filmmakers and artists who had been part of our workshop series. Mm-hmm. So we approached several people earlier in the year and sort of commissioned new works to be presented as part of this festival by these artists. One of them is Lucy Kerr, who is a choreographer, a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I first met her through our workshop series. She had taken a workshop with us. And later that year, I had gone to a performance she presented where she'd incorporated the moving image into a dance presentation at the Cave.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really impressed with the work, and I approached her and asked her, you know, would she be interested in creating something new to premiere as part of Mono 10?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great opportunity for us to kind of provide her with the cameras that are, you know, normally accessible through our rentals program. We could give her film stock. We went to the darkroom with her, and we hand-processed a lot of the footage, worked with her to help present this new piece, Look For Me, which will premiered this weekend, Saturday, at the Center for Performance Research. Yeah, I mean, that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
7 it's o'clock okay. It still shows, sold out. So.
So there you go anyway. But it's good to still show people, look, this is what we do. This is the kinds of experiences we're offering. And, you know, they're going over real well. People are embracing this. You're providing, I think, types of programming that it's harder to find in other festivals and other...
Yeah, I wanted to present kind of the full breadth of what we're doing right now currently. And as we're growing, we have the increased capability to support the production of new works, you know, to support people beyond the kind of introductory workshops that we offer. And that's through increased facilities and just a better structure and support with our board of directors now and our operations manager. And, you know, I think there have been 5 new films that we were able to support the production of this year. The first film was new work by one of our former workshop participants, Monica Conception. We'd approached her about creating a new piece and supported her in making a new color film on 16mm that we presented as part of the Brooklyn Fireproof's summer screening series.
Mm-hmm. And is that a separate screening series?
That was something that they were putting on. They've also been extremely supportive of what we're doing. And they had approached us and asked us if we had anything that would kind of fit the theme of the summer series, which was kind of horror, thriller, slasher films. So knowing that, we approached Monica about creating a new piece, and we were able to provide her the studio space to shoot it in, the camera, the film stock. We processed the film ourselves. And then presented her work as part of the series, which was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely like to do more of that as we move forward.
The full package of offering the full infrastructure for a filmmaker.
Yeah.
It's soup to nuts in a way.
I think our educational initiatives act as an entry point mm-hmm. into this world mm-hmm. of traditional filmmaking, but also, you know, they're different for everyone. Some people come at it. They've already taken film in school, and it's an opportunity for them to get their hands back on this equipment or just.
Where are you from? Where did you grow up, I should ask?
I was born in East L.A.
Mean streets.
Around, kind of. I spent most of my, younger youth in Downey, California.
Downey?
Yeah.
Is that part of L.A.?
Yeah. Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
It's where Suburbia was shot. You ever see the film
mm-hmm.
Suburbia?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So that was shot there. Home of the oldest McDonald's.
Oh, so that really does.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes, this vegan, definitely. Some bragging rights.
Right. Natalie's vegan, too.
Oh, cool.
FYI.
And then, around middle school, my mm-hmm. family moved to the East Coast. And since then, I've kind of been all over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've
been in New York for the last 11 years now.
I would say you're a New Yorker. So you within a year, you're saying you started Mono Noir?
Actually, yeah. It's a little less than a year, actually.
That's a really brilliant thing to do because it's like you build yourself in, the structure in place that, gives you a purpose and a raison d'être. And then it's grown into this thing, an institution in New York. It's pretty impressive, actually.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I moved here kind of in a transition I went through a film program in the Czech Republic studying traditional stop motion animation
mm-hmm.
and was introduced to a lot of earlier avant-garde work
mm-hmm.
and was really excited about, specifically expanded cinema forms and alternative projection. So having moved to the city, I wanted to engage, as best I could. I wanted to meet the people who were making this kind of work and I wanted to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Community, and I thought the best way was just to kind of have this open call and present the first Mono Noir festival. And
what does that expression mean for those of us who
Mono Noir? The term itself is rooted in Japanese culture, and I think it's first attributed to the Tale of Genji, one of the oldest stories, Japanese stories, and. It refers to a connection with the ephemeral or something that's fleeting
mm-hmm.
in nature. And I thought having the festival be presentation of work that were expanded cinema performative in nature, that they kind of were this special moment working counterculture to streaming media and digital media, you know, this sort of singular passive viewing experience that we all participate in every day.
And which is, you know, mass marketed and mass produced for us, too. It's that there's a lot of money behind all that.
So, yeah, it was important to put the emphasis on, you know, being present, kind of be here now. And I think, you know, it's exciting. And that first year, I remember vividly going to the venue, and an hour before there was no one there. And I thought, oh my gosh, no one's going to show up.
Yeah, I've had that experience.
I think we all have.
And then nobody does. Yeah. That's the difference.
And it was, I had convinced the space, Galapagos Art Space.
Oh, sure.
At their former.
Dumbo at the time?
No, their former.
Oh, no. Oh, they were in.
Still on North 6th in Williamsburg.
Williamsburg, sure.
And I had convinced them to give me a discount on the space because I had done the festival on a Sunday evening of the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. And
savvy.
Yeah, actually,
everybody's home.
80 people came out that first year, and you know, that was capacity for their back room. And it was a very warm, you know, and kind of touching experience for me.
Yeah, that.
And yeah, something that's also really amazing is that my call for entries just consisted of me reverse searching online to see what film departments and programs within the United States still had film, and then also sending the call for entries to microcinemas and institutions that I knew ran, you know, similar programming. And one of the artists who came out was Paul Clipson, who's a filmmaker from San Francisco. And, you know, of course I had absolutely no money to put on the first event. And, you know, he was willing to cover the cost of his own flight to come out and present his work. And it was one of his first collaborations with a live musician. And, you know, since then he's gone on to create a lot of similar work. He submitted a piece again for consideration this year. And, you know, we chose to include that within the programming. So he'll present that on December 3rd.
Were you able to fly him out this time? I don't know.
Thanks to all of our wonderful sponsors, we were able to cover the cost of transportation. And
excuse me, I'm fighting.
Yeah, it's been really amazing to see the community grow. And I think last year was one of our, you know, largest turnouts to date. We had almost 900 people in attendance last year over the two nights presenting the work of 33 artists. Someone came up to me in the audience and said, you know, you must be so excited to see almost 400 people, 400 strangers coming out to this thing that you put together. And looking out on the audience, I realized they're not strangers, you know? They're really people from our community.
Right.
You know, definitely there are people there I don't know, but I would say about 80% of the people are people that we've met or engaged with in some way
over the years.
And, you know, to have all these opportunities between education and film distro and rentals and screenings and speaking engagements and the festival, you know, it's a very, I'm very fortunate to have the opportunity to not just present work to a large audience, but actually have these very intimate settings throughout the years to really engage and meet these people.
Right. And have a meaningful experience as well as relationship. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know their names.
You even know their names.
I
well, you know, it's when you came, you guys came on my radar was, I was on the Brooklyn Arts Council, you know, grant committee, and so you might have had a few couple of years where some dimes trickled through. We had no money, but we would give to Mano Nowari every time.
So another large component of our 10th anniversary is that we've made an announcement of one of our largest donations in kind to date. Last year, during the lead up to our 9th annual festival, I had been calling around looking for support to help us put on the festival, and I called one of the, you know, less than half a dozen motion picture labs remaining.
I remember this story. Yeah. You were basically donated a lab.
Yeah.
Or the equipment.
So,
right? So you, if I remember correctly, you told me this, like, you went down to Texas, was it? Or?
Yeah, so I had called a lab in Dallas, Texas, with the intention of asking them if they'd like to contribute a small amount of a donation in kind so that we could promote their lab, you know, to our community. And they told me that they were actually closing their doors.
Shuddering.
And yeah, like I said, this lab is one of less than half a dozen still remaining in the United States. And for an organization that works so hard to promote these traditional filmmaking techniques and make them accessible to the public, you know, hearing that one of these labs is closing is a huge deal.
Sure, sure. It's a significant percentage of that.
Yeah.
So it's, but they ended up offering stuff like gratis and training you, right? You went down and they trained you so you could literally dismantle their operation and re-unmantle here wherever you were going to do that.
So which is just really a few weeks before the festival last year, they asked I come down and kind of prove that I was serious.
Right.
Because it's a big undertaking.
Measure your bona fides.
Yeah, I went down with one of our instructors who was available, Kyle Correa, who's also a filmmaker, and we started disassembling. Then after the festival in December, I flew back down and spent about 3 weeks in Dallas getting trained on the scanning machine, working with their lab manager to understand the linear processing machine as well. And yeah, then a group of four of us disassembled the lab and drove it back up here in a truck. And
is it in storage?
It's in storage right now.
Yeah.
We're working to raise funds to open a space to not only expand upon what we're doing through our education and all of our initiatives, but also to give home to what is the first, our nation's first nonprofit 501c3 motion picture lab.
Has a new one opened since we could say the dissolution of or the advent of enforced digital projection? In the last, say, 6-7 years, probably conservative, right, where theaters had to, you know, they had no choice but to replace film projection with digital projection.
Yeah,
I'm wondering if since then a new house has opened up for this type of thing, a lab, and I don't think probably one has. It wouldn't make any sense.
No,
so you would doing something that at one time is makes no sense. Except that it does, because you can open it when you have things in place where you know that you are not going to lose money on it.
Right.
However that's done. I mean,
well, there are a few,
you have that advantage.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few factors. I mean, when we started 10 years ago, there were probably almost 20 labs, and, you know, 10 years earlier, probably over 100.
Right.
And part of our case, part of our application for our 501c3 was kind of stressing the decline of the facilities and, you know, the real need to have something like this exist. And, you know, you're right. There was a push towards DCP within the motion picture industry for the theaters, and whether that was for convenience or for control over the media. Mm-hmm. And I know that, there was a push towards that, certainly. And I think that, you know, what we're doing is something kind of off that radar totally. And while the economics of opening a motion picture lab right now don't make sense to a business person who's looking to create a profit, for someone like us, you know, it makes total sense. It's something that we can run on a small scale, and rather than being a lab that would serve a commercial industry, we're not going to be running dailies for a television show or, you know, a quote-unquote major motion picture. So, you know, that business and work will still go to some of the remaining labs who are, you know, partners and sponsors of our organization. We're really going to focus on independent filmmakers, people who are just starting out, artists who are working in film, in the gallery setting, we won't need to maintain and operate the lab, you know, every day, you know, for that reason as well. So we can set the structure up, you know, for example, we could set it up and just run color neg once a month and black and white negative once a month.
Gang things up, as they say.
Yeah, so we could say, all right, everybody knows that on the 10th of the month, Mono Noir runs black and white neg. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the economics can be, you know, changed and we can support our community on the level and it's all about scalability.
Yeah.
But still, you know, making it accessible and not only as a service, you know, to those artists in the community, but also it's something where, you know, community members and people who are learning, you know, film for the first time with us, or maybe even veterans, will have the opportunity to come in and see this kind of equipment and be up close and personal with it, you know, have access to tour the laboratory and understand how, you know, it does work in a major motion picture laboratory, something like Color Lab or Photochem or CineLab. You know, they'll have access to it as a learning tool, you know, to better understand the process.
Yeah. It's great. It's a great story too. How it all came together like that. Serendipitous. Yeah, and reached out to them. They would have shuttered and who knows what would have happened to that?
Actually, it's really amazing because it is in Dallas where I had been teaching these workshops as part of the Oak Cliff Film Fest, and I had no idea it was there myself.
Right, that you said.
I thought I had an understanding of
it. It was like business to business almost, this place, because, you know, the public didn't really have an awareness of it. Did you, do you have relationships with the other remaining organizations? Because in case something like that were to happen, you know, again, you...
Yeah, I mean, if we try and understand, you know, the current landscape and be supportive of all the different institutions and organizations and collectives and individual artists that are part of this, kind of understanding our place and the need, it's important to do that. And, you know, we're aware, every time a lab closed, we're, you know, extremely aware of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought I had a full understanding of the current landscape in terms of, you know, motion picture labs. But here, I'd given this workshop and someone asked me, oh, have you ever been to the lab in Dallas? And I said, no, gosh. And I went and got a tour just the year before.
Oh.
So, you know, and then they told me that they had processed Linkletter's Boyhood, and, you know, I had no idea they were even there. All, you know, there are other companies and businesses that are also have been closing, and another one of them was the Oxbury company, who had built 2D animation stands and also optical printing machines in South Orange, New Jersey, and just after maybe a day after I returned from Dallas with the lab, I had received a call from the acting, you know, president of the organization or company, saying that they were going to be closing their doors to their facility and they'd be interested in donating in kind a lot of the parts and components to their optical printers. So I went over there with our winter work study, Jade, and one of our other instructors, Akiko. And we were able to procure and secure all the components to these optical printing machines, different levers and knobs and specially machined parts, kind of a full library of replacement parts for these machines, which will help us to maintain our own Oxbury optical printer when the space opens, but also to serve the greater community, international community, everyone who has one of these machines, you know, CalArts has one, SAIC has an Oxbury optical printer, and these schools and universities, if they ever need anything to replace the machine, rather than, you know, not having access to the parts they need now, they can come to us, and, you know, we're happy to support them, you know, in maintaining their equipment in this way and so that it can be continued to be taught at other institutions.
You know, right. What about the space in South Orange, though?
Unfortunately, the space they were in had been flooded multiple times.
Oh,
you know, in the last 6-7 years, there have been some crazy storms, you know, have affected New York, but also the kind of the flatlands in New Jersey. And I think...
I see. Basically, it's water in the first place.
Yeah, I think it was underwater.
Is this like near the Meadowlands?
Yeah,
like
it's right near by the Netherlands.
Yeah, I know the area. It's like this whole industrial area there.
Yeah, but
it's probably just on marsh.
Marsh.
Yeah.
So a lot of the components, electrical components, were damaged in those floods. Oh, but fortunately, a lot of the kind of movements, they're called movements, the different components that fit with inside of the projection elements and the camera elements of these beautiful machines are still preserved. So we were able to, you know, obtain those. And, it's exciting.
Check out, again, MonoAware film.com for... Well, this festival, but all the other initiatives and programs that, that they offer. And if you're a filmmaker and this sounds you know, appealing to you, reach out, get involved, join the community. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you.
It's great, great sitting with you.
Cool.
It's coming through a crack in the walls on a visionary flood of alcohol from the staggering the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy has come to the USA.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Let's make this short. Thank you for your continuing support of the podcast. Stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You can go to filmwaxradio.com for more information or for reaching out to me. Thank you for listening. Filmwax Radio is part of the Showbiz Studios podcast network and presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, take care of yourself and those who you love.
Heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do ya? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift. The baffled king composing Alleluia. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Your faith was strong, but you needed proof. Saw her bathing on the roof, her beauty and the moonlight overthrew ya. She tied you to a kitchen chair, she broke your throne and she cut your hair, but from your lips she drew the hallelujah, hallelujah. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Maybe I've been here before, I know this room, and I've walked this floor. I used to live alone before I knew you. I've seen your flag on the marble arch, but love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.